not easily provoked. It doesn't think evil. It doesn't rejoice in iniquity. So when we find ourselves reflecting these qualities in our life, the ones we ought to be, and avoiding those characteristics that we ought not to be reflecting, then Paul says we will know that we have godly love. And this is not a definition that is in opposition to the laying down of our life for one another. But this is a more practical, a more detailed examination of what godly love looks like. You could insert the word Christ, as some brethren have done, for the word love or charity in these four verses. And there's a picture of the life of Christ and the character of Christ, because his life was one of manifesting God's love. Love is kind, Paul says, and the Greek word is means to be useful or to be helpful to others. And this isn't just a warm smile or a word of encouragement on Sunday morning or at the Bible class. If you turn over to Ephesians 4, we find that Paul connects kindness with forgiveness in verse 32. And be kind, he says, to one another. Tenderhearted, forgiving one another as God in Christ forgave you. So it isn't just a word of encouragement. Kindness, as a characteristic of godly love, will forgive a brother or sister who has sinned against us. So if you want to show kindness to someone, don't just open the door for them on Sunday morning. And we don't mean to demean that in any way. But forgive them if they sin against you, if they publicly shame you, if they bring accusations against you, if they misread your motives, or they take what you have legitimately done wrong and broadcast it to the ecclesia. Forgive them, Paul says, out of a tender heart. In Proverbs 10 and 12, the same principle, hate stirs up strife, but love covers a multitude of sins. 1 Peter 4 and 8 says that above all things have fervent love, for love covers a multitude of sins. And if you combine 1 Peter 4 and 8 with James 5 and 20, you see a description where when sin has engulfed an ecclesia, it can unleash great power in that ecclesia for evil, for bad things. And oftentimes that happens because there's a fallout between one brother or another, or because somebody has made a mistake, and instead of the mistake being admitted and forgiven, the mistake grows and becomes a tremendous power for evil within the ecclesia. If that mistake had been forgiven and it would have been handled in godly love at the very beginning, all of that evil, all of that power for bad things could have been covered, could have been eliminated by godly love. Love is not envious, Paul says back in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. It's not jealous. It doesn't just want what's best for itself. Instead, it wants what's best for others, spiritually best for others. It can rejoice with them in their successes just as easily as it can sorrow with them in their failings. It's not concerned about it, what it doesn't have. It's making sure. That's what godly love is, making sure that others have what they need. It doesn't vaunt itself, or as in the New King James Version it says, it doesn't parade itself. It doesn't publicize its own achievements. It doesn't look for recognition. It isn't motivated based on the praise of others. It's motivated out of a love for God. And then he says love is not puffed up. It's not arrogant. And the Greek word there means to inflate, to blow up. And it's used in the New Testament associated with pride and how pride can puff us up, can blow us up. And there's already been four times in 1 Corinthians where Paul has talked about this problem of arrogance or being puffed up. So he's not talking about the pride of the Gentiles. He's not talking about the pride of the unbelievers. He's talking about the pride of the Corinthian believers. Take a look back in 1 Corinthians 5, for instance. There was the problem of a man was living with his father's wife, likely his stepmother. And there were some in the ecclesia that were saying, not a problem. We should love this brother and sister, and we should take no action against them. And Paul calls this being puffed up and arrogant for their refusal to take the necessary act of separation. Verse 1, it is actually reported that there is immorality among you, and of a kind that is not found even among the Gentiles. For a man is living with, as it is in the RSV, hath, I believe it is in the authorized version, his father's wife. And you are puffed up. Ought ye not rather to mourn? Let him who has done this be removed or taken away from you. And what this shows us is that pride, when it exists among believers, is in failing to submit ourselves to the word. So if a brother or sister brings a false doctrine or a wrong conduct into our midst, it's not godly love that speaks up and says we should tolerate it. Paul calls it arrogance because we refuse to submit ourselves to what the word teaches. The toleration of such error is a reflection of pride. It may be human love that we hear. You know, we need to be considerate and understanding, but Paul says if it's a violation of a first principle doctrine or conduct, we are to remove it from our midst. In chapter 8 of Corinthians is another example of where he identifies the evil that can arise from knowledge puffing us up. And he provides an insight into how knowledge and pride can have a devastating effect upon the ecclesia. And he shows why it's important for all members of the body to be considerate of one another. Chapter 8 is not about a first principle. It's not about a doctrine. It's not about first principle conduct. It has nothing to do with separation. We don't disfellowship over the issues in chapter 8 like we do over the issues in chapter 5. And he shows us in this chapter that when even a single member without love becomes puffed up and arrogant, insisting on his own way, the ecclesial body will suffer. The issue of chapter 8 is the issue of meat offered to idols. And we need to recognize this up front. It's a matter of conscience. He says that in verse 7, verse 10, and verse 12. This is not a first principle. It's a matter of conscience. Not like the immorality of chapter 5. And we need to understand, too, the divine hierarchy that has been revealed in the Word. First principles transcend matters of conscience. And matters of conscience transcend items that are not first principles. So if a brother or sister comes to us and says, you know, I just can't, in all good conscience, separate from that brother who is living with his father's wife. I just can't bring myself to do it. What is Paul's answer? Change your conscience. But if the issue is different, if it's an issue of meat offered to idols, Paul says, take another look. Because matters of conscience transcend issues that are not first principles. Verses 1 to 3, he identifies the danger of knowledge alone. Now concerning food offered to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. It edifies. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. But if one loves God, one is known by him. You see, knowledge without godly love, he says in verse 1, will lead to pride because the self is puffed up. And being puffed up, it's going to lead to destruction. It's not edification that knowledge without love leads to. It's destruction, as we see explained in the rest of the chapter. Both our own destruction and the destruction of others. God's love, on the other hand, godly love, will edify others. It will build up the body that needs to learn to work together in harmony. And he says, we all possess knowledge. We all start out on the road with knowledge. And all of us possess knowledge, and if we don't have godly love, we're starting down that road of being puffed up. All of us, every single one of us, needs to add godly love to the knowledge that we have. Because if we have knowledge without godly love, it can be very deceptive. He says in verse 2, you may think you know, but you don't know as you ought to know. But when we add godly love to our knowledge, it's only then that we reach the ought to know stage. In verse 3, then he says, the divine standard is not what we know. The divine standard is to love God. Only then are we known of him. And then verses 4 to 6, he describes the knowledge part. See, there's two pieces here in chapter 8. There's the knowledge part, and there's the godly love part that needs to be added to the knowledge. Verses 4 through 6, this is the knowledge part. He's now going to answer their question regarding the meat offered to idols within the context of two brethren. There's the strong brother and there's the weak brother. There's the brother with knowledge and there's the brother without knowledge. And he begins. There's the brother right, who has all the weight of Bible evidence on his side and who can testify to the rightness of his position. And he states that in irrefutable terms, idols don't exist. There is only one God and one Lord. That's the knowledge part of this issue. And since idols don't exist, this brother says, who brings us this knowledge, we ought to be free to eat meat because they're being offered to something that is non-existent. And brother Wright can bring a truckload of evidence to show in these matters of conscience. I'm right. One God, one Lord, no idols. Let's eat. And then Paul goes on to the rest of the chapter to describe the godly love part that needs to be added to the knowledge for edification to take place. Your eating, he says in verse 7, will lead to his eating, and it will result in his conscience being defiled. However, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through being hitherto accustomed to idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. So he says in verse 9, don't let your knowledge, don't let this liberty of yours, this liberty of being right in your understanding, become a stumbling block to your weak brother. Only take care lest this liberty of yours somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. Because a good conscience is critical, absolutely critical to discipleship. It's bound up, Paul says in 1 Timothy 1, with a pure heart and a sound, sincere faith. If our conscience ever becomes seared, we begin to act without regard to it, as Paul describes in 1 Timothy 4 and in Titus 1. And when our conscience is seared or defiled, and we begin to act with a defiled conscience, Paul says we lose our hope. That's how critical it is that we not act with a defiled conscience. And if we are causing one another to act with a defiled conscience, we are taking away the hope of one another. That's Paul's message in this chapter. He goes on in verse 11. We're not talking now about stumbling over a stone, but we're talking about a serious stumbling block. Because he says in verse 11, and so by your knowledge, this weak man, this weak brother is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. So your eating of the meat leads to the destruction of this brother. He will perish, as it is in the Authorized Version. And it all happens because your knowledge is applied without godly love, and it causes him to perish. And in verse 13, Paul says, therefore, if food is a cause of my brother's falling, or If it makes my brother to offend, I will never eat meat, lest I cause my brother to offend. And the word there means to be entrapped by sin. It's the word that we get the English word scandal from, scandalizo. It means that it leads to apostasy. This isn't just a stumble where the brother picks himself up and dusts himself off, says, sorry, there must have been a misunderstanding, and goes on. The brother or sister become entrapped in sin. They apostatize. And as a result, sin takes back hold of their life. So we ask ourselves, well, how in the world did we get from eating meat offered to an idol that doesn't exist to my brother or sister becoming entrapped in sin? Where's the connection? And the answer is to understand what was happening in the first century. the pagan religion of the first century was built upon temple worship and prostitution that accompanied that temple worship. And the temples in those days were like restaurants, the historians would tell us. You go in and you have a meal, and then you have the option of engaging in entertainment. And it's all built upon the religion. And you see what action could be led to if a person sat down to eat meat offered to idols. The proof of this, and we need to recognize that some of the Gentile believers had come out of this way of life. It was a practice for them to go to these temples and to have a meal and then to engage in immorality. That was the life they were trying to leave behind. And it was easy for them to go back into that way of life that needed to be put off. In Revelation 2, we won't take the time to go through it, but take a look in verse 14. You likely recall the warning that Christ makes to the ecclesia at Pergamos. Some thought it was okay to participate. I suppose we should really connect it. So let's just turn briefly to Revelation 2 and verse 14. Some actually thought it was okay in Pergamos to engage themselves in this type of conduct. This is what Christ calls the doctrine of Balaam. I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel that they might eat food sacrificed to idols and practice immorality. What did Balaam teach them? We won't, but we could go back to Numbers 25. What did it all start with? It started with a little food. They ate. They bowed their heads to the idols. Their conscience became defiled. And wham! Sin is unleashed. 24,000 Israelites will die from an event that started with eating a little food offered to an idol. You see, the religion in the first century and the religion of the Moabites was built on this structure. That if the gods are engaging in immorality, that's what we'll do because we find it pleasurable. And it would all start with a little food offered to an idol. And it leads to a defiled conscience. Balaam couldn't curse the Israelites, but he could teach Balak how to defile their conscience. And once a brother or sister has a defiled conscience, there is no stopping sin. The proof of that is that each of us have been through a situation in our life when our conscience has been defiled. And that leaves us sitting or standing somewhere, and we ask ourselves, how in the world did I get myself here? And it was because of a defiled conscience that took place a while before. It gets so bad in Israel that a man takes his Midianite woman and he walks before Moses, standing at the tabernacle. And the rest of the Israelites are weeping over what's happening. And he walks and parades right by him and takes the woman into his tent. That's what will happen when a conscience has been defiled. And it takes the faithful response of Phinehas to end the plague. Mixing food with religion and sinful pleasure. That's why the Greeks had the female gods and the male gods, because it encouraged that way of life. Back to 1 Corinthians 8. A weak brother sees me go in to one of these temples, me being the strong brother. And I've got the truckload of evidence to support why and how I should be able to eat meat offered to idols. And in verse 10 we read, "For if anyone sees you, a man of knowledge, at table in an idol's temple, might not he be encouraged, if his conscience is weak, to eat for food offered to idols?" And then this process of a defiled conscience and sin taking over leaves him in a state of apostasy. I can go in, eat the meat, and leave. He sees me go in, comes back the next day, and the results are disastrous. I think if we wanted to equate a modern-day example, I don't know if you have casinos in Vernon, or if you have casinos yet in British Columbia, but they're starting to pop up where I come from. For a long time, it was just the Indians that could have them, and they were way off wherever. But then they changed the law just a little bit and gave the Indians a little bit of the land in the urban areas, and now we've got casinos all over. So here I come with my truckload of evidence, or of Bible evidence. Is it okay to eat meat cooked in a restaurant? I suppose so. And I happen to love a steak dinner. And the best steak dinner in town is cooked in that casino. Now, this is a casino where the restaurant is really detached from the gambling. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my truckload of knowledge and Bible evidence, and I'm going to go in, and there's even a separate door. And I'm going to go in and have my steak dinner, and I'm going to get up and leave and walk out the same door I came in. Never went through those other doors where the gambling takes place. And who happens to see me go in? A brother who was just baptized in the last year, who loved to gamble. But he gave it all up when he started coming to the seminars. And the ecclesia started to spend a lot of time with him. And he was suffering through trials and temptations. And he finally decided, I'm going to put on Christ. I'm going to leave that way of life behind. He sees me go in. He comes back the next day and says, well, I'm going to have a dinner in that restaurant. And then he finishes his meal. And he goes over to the door and he kind of looks. Wonder what they've made any changes. And before you know it, he gets sucked in. And he apostatizes. And he goes back to the very way of life that he was trying to put off. So this brother, who had a former trouble with this, with gambling and all the loose living that it promotes, is lost. Why? Because I wanted a steak dinner. That's why. Now put this in the context of what we've looked at this week. Because that's what Paul does. See this in the context of Romans 8. See this in the context of God's love and all that God has done for this brother. See this in the context of the cross of Christ and Christ having given his life for this brother. All of this has been done on his behalf to bring this brother into Christ, to bring this brother to salvation. And what I've done by insisting upon my way is to negate all of the love of God. And I have negated the love of Christ and the power of the cross that Paul said he would know nothing among the Corinthians except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And in the life of this weak brother, I have nullified it all because I wanted a steak dinner. And how does Paul describe that? Take care lest this liberty of yours somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. Verse 11, and so by your knowledge this weak man is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died, thus sinning against your brother and wounding their brethren and weak conscience. When it is weak, you sin against Christ. God will hold me accountable because I had knowledge. I had a truckload of Bible knowledge on my side, and I acted without godly love. And that's the danger of where all of our knowledge will leave us if we don't have godly love in addition to it. My impact on the ecclesia with all of my knowledge, and I'm just using myself as an example, I'm not trying to take anything upon myself, but if we take all of our knowledge that we acquire and we don't have godly love, you know what the impact that we have upon the ecclesia is? It is no different than Balaam's impact upon the children of Israel.
Our brother Ken has certainly given us a lot to think about this week, especially today. It hits right at the heart, doesn't it? Right at home, a lot of these things. especially the way he ended up. He looked at David's love for Yahweh, which was seen in the death of Goliath, Jonathan's love, his covenant with David, and the power of godly love. That seems to be the theme of today. And it made Jonathan, because of his love of David, to have that godly love. And yet, Jonathan and his father Saul were opposites. One had love, the other had envy. The two ends of the whole situation. Strife came into the picture. And yet David had godly love for Saul right to the very end, didn't he? And Jonathan loved David as his own soul. Ken spoke about ecclesial life and how we should have godly love, how it should permeate everyone within the ecclesia. Without this godly love, no matter what you do in the ecclesia, how good you are, how much you help those in the ecclesia, without godly love and that intent behind it, it's not the true love that God wants. Disharmony can be, can shipwreck an ecclesia. And we can spend a lifetime of doing an ecclesia without love. And we know what love represents in the patience, being kind, and all the other things. Always positive knowledge and pride. Otherwise, we're puffed up and we become arrogant in many cases. We'll bring our class to a close this afternoon with the singing of Hymn 87, after which we'll ask our brother James Larson to close with prayer. Dear Lord and Father of mankind, forgive our foolish ways. Reclothe us in our rightful mind. In purer lives, thy service find. In deeper reverence praise. Hymn 87.